We've been in this village all our lives, and we're supposed to share it with that lot. We don't even know them.
When you eat together, you stick together.
My mother always said that.
Some of the locals are struggling too.
Everywhere's closed. Even the school's gone. We can't even look after our own.
My first experience of racism came sat under this very tree some 20 years ago. At the time, there was about 5 or 6 kids playing on that swing right there. I was waiting for them to come off so I could go play on it. And I sat here patiently waiting. I went to play on the slide, the climbing frame. But everyone was at the swing.
Building up the courage, thinking if I go over and push them on the swing, maybe they'll let me on. Maybe I could befriend them. I came over and I started to push. And immediately, one of them shouts, "Oh, what's that?" What they went on to say, I won't repeat, but it's not left me to this day.
And we went to a fish and chip shop up at Woodhouse Hill. And the fish and chips was in the newspaper, just like how we were taught. We were told that it was like when we're in Jamaica. I got fish and chips. Guess what? I didn't know that you were to put the vinegar and the salt on it.
I think it would be pretty boring if we all came from Yorkshire.
This is solidarity. This is about we'll do something together.
It takes a strength to build something new. It takes strength to build something beautiful.
Shukran. Do you know what shukran means? It means thank you.
Shukran.
Shukran.
You are listening to Grim Up North, a podcast about the North from the North.
Welcome to Grim Up North, a podcast about the North from the North. I'm Adrian Scott.
And I'm Matt Carr.
And this is the first episode of our second series. It's been a while.
It feels like a long, long time, doesn't it?
We've both had lots of projects going on.
We have, but I'm really glad to be back now.
So am I.
And the subject of today's programme is a complex subject.
It is a complex subject. Welcome to the North, we've called it.
With a question mark.
With a question mark. So we're talking about migration to the North. Mm-hmm. Who are the people who came here? Why did they come? Good question too. How have they been received? Is the North, which it's always been sort of famous for, it's a really welcoming place, yeah. You know, people are right friendly. Yeah. Well, let's see. So these are some of the questions we're going to be talking about. And we'll be speaking to a fantastic woman called Zeba Malik, the author of a marvellous memoir about growing up in Bradford in the 70s and 80s.
Stunning book, really.
I thought it was wonderful. It's called We Are Muslim, mm-hmm. Please. But okay, we need to get into the subject a little bit. When we talk about migration, what are we talking about, Matt?
Well, as you say, it's a vast subject that covers a lot of history and we can't take it all in. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that the idea of outsiders, foreigners, in Sheffield, once upon a time, people from Hallam were considered foreigners and outsiders.
Well, that's true.
So, you know, as these cities came together, the whole chain, the concept of who was foreign, who was inside, who was outside changed.
It's an interesting question.
But if you want to go back to first principles, there's some really interesting tombstones and altar stones found up in near Hadrian's Wall. And there's one here, and an altar was found in Marypot, Cumbria, from Roman era, Roman era. And it says, to the genius of the place, to fortune the homebringer, to eternal Rome, and to good fate, Gaius Cornelius Peregrinus, tribune of the cohort, decurion of his hometown of Saldae, in the province of Mauritania, gladly, willingly, and deservedly fulfilled his vow. Mauritania is south of Morocco. This is Africa, basically. So this guy died here in Roman times, and there are many things like that. There are tombstones showing that Asturians were based in the Roman cavalry up near Hadrian's Wall.
Wow.
That Syrians were there. That also that there's one says to the shades of the dead, Barates of Palmyra commemorates Regina, his freedwoman and wife, a Catuvalunian. Wow. So this was a marriage between a Syrian and a member of a Celtic tribe.
Goodness me.
So that was up in Hadrian's Wall. This is a long time ago.
This is a lot. And he talks about genius loci, the genius of a place.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Fantastic.
So this is not always understood when people think of how our country was formed, let alone the particular regions we're talking about, the north.
Well, exactly.
But if you look at the north, you can look at some of the different peoples who come here. Vikings, Normans. Yes. Chinese.
My ancestors, Vikings. I've got.
Why am I not surprised by that?
I've got Norse in my DNA.
Right. For some reason, it doesn't surprise me at all. Really, you should have worn an appropriate outfit to make this podcast. So yes, Jews, obviously.
Yeah.
Lascars, Indian sailors on the East India Company ships to Liverpool,
right.
Hull, South Shields. Slaves and descendants of slaves who settled in Toxteth in Liverpool, yeah, in the Georgian era and before the Georgian era.
Right.
Between 1880 and 1920, the north was a major centre of migration from Scotland and Ireland.
Yes, yes, to work in the steelworks, sink the mines, all of that.
Yep. Some historians have estimated that as many as 37% of the 1911 population of the northeast was foreign-born.
Wow.
Or the children of migrants. And that shows today. By 2000, there were communities in Newcastle of people who spoke as their first language, Farsi, Kurdish, Afghani, Albanian, French, Russian, Czech, Turkish, Somali, Arabic, Spanish, Turkish, Gujarati, Sinhalese, Tamil, and Serbo-Croat. And you find similar...
A cornucopia of languages.
Absolutely. The same in Sheffield. More than 120 languages spoken in Sheffield. So
this is not a new phenomenon.
Not at all. But guess what the second language in Yorkshire is?
I don't know. Urdu?
Polish.
But wow.
Yeah, Polish.
Gosh.
Apparently Polish. And Urdu is second in some areas. In West Yorkshire, Kirklees, Bradford.
Right.
Punjabi is second in Calderdale.
Right.
And in York, it's other Chinese.
Oh my
God. So you've got lots of variants that show, you know, within different parts of the north, you know. But not many people would expect that Polish would be the second, would they?
No, not at all. And it gives the lie to that idea that somehow London is this great melting pot of languages. And the north is quite monocultural.
Totally, it really does. It really does. So when you look at the history of the north, as like the history of the country, is a history of people who came here.
Migration.
Who settled here, who made this place their home. We know of some famous ones, Marcus Rashford, Prince Nassim, mm-hmm. Michael Marks from Marks and Spencer's.
Yeah.
Deepak Nandi, Lisa Nandi's father.
Yeah.
Asim Alam, the owner of Hull City. Engels. Friedrich Engels,
oh,
Manchester cotton manager, and so,
gosh,
it's on the surface. Then you could think that the north has been a welcoming place where it's been possible for people to settle easily.
Yeah,
and that has sometimes been the case, but not always.
Not always.
I mean, Priestley, for example, who we've often referred to in this podcast,
a friend of this podcast,
he is JV. Indeed. So Priestley has had a lot to say during his English journey about different migrant communities that he encountered.
He
and not all
has.
Of it was favourable,
no.
Some of it was. Let's have a listen to what he said, for example, about the Jewish emigrants who came to Bradford and who most of whom had left because of World War One.
Right. Okay, let's hear it.
I am not suggesting that these German Jews were better men than we are. The point is that they were different and brought more to the city than bank drafts and lists of customers. They acted as a leaven, just as a colony of typical West Riding folk would act as a leaven in Munich or Moscow. These exchanges are good for everybody. Just lately, when we offered hospitality to some distinguished German Jews who had been exiled by the Nazis, the leader writers in the cheap press began yelping again about keeping the foreigner out. Apart from the miserable meanness of the attitude itself, for the great England, the England admired throughout the world, is the England that keeps open house. The refugee of Mazzini, Marx, Lenin. History shows us that the countries that have opened their doors have gained, just as the countries that have driven out large numbers of its citizens, for racial, religious or political reasons, have always paid dearly for their intolerance. It is one of the innumerable disadvantages of this present age of idiotic nationalism, political and economic, this age of passports and visas and quota, when every country is as difficult to enter or leave as were the Tsar's Russia or the Sultan's Turkey before the war, that it is no longer possible for this admirable leavening process to continue.
Wow, what a... He could write a paragraph, that man.
He could, really, he could. I mean, it's also, you know, this age of nationalism, the miserable meanness of the attitude itself, keeping the foreigner out. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, incredibly familiar.
Plus ça change, right?
Well, he's naming something that I think is extremely important, that word leavening.
Yeah.
You know, that if you took people from Bradford or Sheffield and they put them in Munich, they would leaven the place. And that's what's happened here. The leavening phenomenon of migration, it enriches somewhere.
It does, but isn't it, but on the other hand, it's not always without tensions and problems. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Priestley himself, he says, he goes on from that quote, he says, behind all the new movements of this age, nationalistic, fascistic, communistic, has been more than a suspicion of the mental attitude of a gang of small-town louts ready to throw a brick at the nearest stranger.
Ooh.
I mean, that brick has often been thrown
at
various periods in the history of the North, you know.
Oh, without doubt.
And in fact, Priestley himself, interestingly enough, despite the fact that he's very positive about the mostly... prosperous Jewish merchants who were part of the Bradford wool trade and so on.
He's still less... a synagogue in Bradford.
Right. Well, he's not so positive about the Irish. Okay. In fact, he's quite... Or the Chinese. Some of the comments he makes about Chinese and Irish and English journeys are quite shocking.
I remember that.
You know, he talks about Irish as being... finding a slum and... he says the Irish in general... have never tried to make the places they lived any better. They have settled in the nearest poor quarter and turned it into a slum, he says. Or finding a slum, have promptly settled down to out-slum it.
That's unbelievable. I mean, that's terrible. When I lived in Maltby in South Yorkshire, a mining village, it was the Irish and Scots Catholics that built the school, the church. They had great civic pride. And contributed massively to the community. Oh, well.
But
he falls down sometimes.
Throughout, you know, ever since the Irish started arriving in the North in large numbers post 1845 to 9, during the Irish famine, there were lots of outbreaks of anti-Irish violence in different places of the North. Sometimes it was pure kind of like ethnic competition for jobs, houses, and so on.
Yeah.
But it also had a religious element as well, of clashes between Catholics and Protestant Irish, for example. I mean, in Manchester in 1807, there were some quite vicious anti-Irish riots. In Preston in the 1940s, in Penrith in the 1840s, there were full-on battles between Irish and English workers.
Right.
There were signs of no Irish need apply for jobs.
Well, and that persisted for... right into my lifetime. No Irish, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs.
You remember seeing those kind of signs, do you?
I remember my mum and dad talking about them.
What do they think of it?
They weren't really keen on it.
No. I mean, that shows you then, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
So there's, alongside with this tradition of outsiders, in commas, settling in the North and making the North their home, there's always been resistance to that.
Yeah.
Outright racist resistence at times. I guess because the North is a place where the Industrial Revolution was so important in forming the society of the North, work and working and workers has always been kind of part of this. People have come here to work.
Yeah.
And sometimes they've clashed with people who didn't want them here because they regarded those jobs as their own. For example, in 1919, just after World War I, there were riots in Liverpool.
Right.
Pretty racist riots, really, because soldiers came back from the war expecting to find a home for heroes and all this kind of thing. They found their jobs had gone, some of them. So there were riots in Liverpool that had a very strong racial bias, including there was a horrific incident in which a Bermudan seaman, he was a captain on a Bermudan ship, was chased into the dock and drowned.
Oh, God.
So it's not clear how he drowned, whether he was pushed in or just allowed to drown. It wasn't just in Liverpool. There were riots in other cities in Wales as well in the same period. But it was the same thing. It was basically for jobs, and it had a racist component right there and then.
Yeah. You can see where that tension would come from. I mean, I'm not saying it's right or understandable, but you can see why those communities felt threatened. But, yeah.
Well, the thing that often happens in the history of migration anywhere is that lots of people who are poor end up being put in the
exactly,
same place,
that's
transported
what
to the same
towards.
Place or attracted to the place, and then they find themselves in competition for the few things that there are there. And that's part of the history of the North. I mean,
I think so.
The one of the largest waves of migration to the North began in the 1950s and 60s when people started coming from northern Punjab and Mirpur in Pakistan to work in northern cities, in mill towns, where white workers were no longer taking those jobs. So this wasn't a question of they didn't want, they were pushed out of those jobs. They didn't want those
they
jobs.
Didn't want the, especially night shift.
Yeah, the night shift, yeah. Exactly. And so, I mean, to get a flavour of what that was like, check out this documentary from 1967. It's a World of Tomorrow documentary called A New Kind of Match. it really gives a flavour of how this kind of immigration was seen at that time.
Yes.
Bradford, early morning. The Mohammedan call to the faithful goes out to 16,000 of her citizens. They are Pakistanis, part of the million newcomers to England, a country where racial discrimination is growing. Bradford is usually held up as the leading light in the treatment of immigrants. Tonight, then, Yorkshire versus Pakistan in a new kind of match.
Well, there's a story of the Pakistani who went back home and he was passing through a village that was very quiet and only sparsely populated. And on his return journey, the village was packed. And he said, "What's going on here?" And somebody said, "It's Bradford's holiday week."
Jokes about colour are common in Bradford, one of the few places which has paid more than lip service to the problem of Britain's new citizens. They're only 2% of our population, yet they form 40% of our National Health Service. Our transport services and our basic industries would buckle without them.
But the first annual report of the Race Relations Board, to be published at the end of this month, makes uncomfortable reading. In industry, housing, insurance, mortgages, the colour bar is growing, and there are demands for new laws banning all discrimination.
Employers and unions have joined in uneasy wedlock against introducing laws to force integration. They want the solution to be a voluntary one, to be able to say, "Don't call us, we'll call you."
In Bradford, the call was for Labour, and they got the Pakistanis. In such numbers that the afternoon train from London was known locally as the Orient Express.
In Pakistan, the average annual income is £20 a head. In mills like Westcroft's, with overtime, they make that in a week. Little wonder they mortgaged land, borrowed and scrounged to raise the £140 airfare to come to Bradford, which loomed like the promised land.
We have about 240 coloured employees here, out of a total number of employees of about 370, so at a ratio of 2 to 1. Quite frankly, we just can't do without coloured labour in the textile trade.
For managing directors like Tom Saul, their future is limited.
And I cannot think that, in the present generation, that there's any possibility that these people will come to the top. Possibly in a few years, you could see these people in as foremen, but I cannot see them at a sort of executive level.
After some early resentment, relations are now reasonable on the floor.
These that we've got here are all good, clean lads, you know, no dirty habits. I mean, they're good workers, they're better than some white men. You can get a bag to a white man, can't you?
Goodness me.
Astounding, isn't it?
It is. That idea that somehow these people can't rise above the level of foreman, said in that very authoritative English accent.
I can't do without these people.
Quite frankly, we can't do without
them.
It's just incredible to judge another human being with that kind of haughtiness.
Yeah, the haughtiness is quite clear, even though the documentary was actually a kind of hard-hitting documentary about what it called then racial discrimination in 1967. It itself has a kind of rather condescending attitude, doesn't it?
Condescending, really? That's the
word. It's kind of they scrounge, the idea that they scrounge to get there.
It's not that sort of naked racism. It's a condescension that somehow these people are a substandard that but we can't do without them, so we've got to have them here.
Yeah.
And who knows what they could rise to, you know, maybe prime ministers. You never know, do you?
The thing was, though, what happened then, though, is that, you know, a lot of those people, as they call them, were not expected to stay permanently.
No.
They were seen as a kind of, short-term solution to labour supply. But then the mills closed, of course.
Yes.
Most of the mills closed, you know, but when the first generation came that feature in this programme, they were often living on their own in shared rooms.
Men often
shared rooms, then changing shifts and so on. That's really right. A basic never, kind of gas arbeiter. Yeah, absolutely. The hot bed.
Yeah.
They were, and you know, when kids came, they were often bused to schools outside the areas where they lived. They were only able to work in the factories at that time. And they were also subject quite often to vicious street level racism.
Awful.
You hear horrendous stories from the early 70s of what people had to deal with. And then you had this sort of generational shift, because as is often the case, the kind of first generation migrants were more disposed to keep their heads down and just take it because their situation was precarious.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't know if they could be kicked out if they did anything. But then with the kind of second and third generations, in the late 70s and 80s, you start to see the emergence of the Asian youth movements, which were...
I remember this in my lifetime.
Do you?
At my school, which was in a rather leafy middle-class area, they bussed in kids from all over the city. It was an attempt to create some kind of equality. And there were just a few Pakistani kids. And their lives were a misery. Mm. I remember it. And I remember thinking even at the time, this is outrageous. But you watched, it certainly in a city like Sheffield, you watched that community establish itself and gain self-confidence, which is what you're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this was a period in which kind of... anti-racism was very much influenced by decolonization, by anti-racist movements around the world, by anti-apartheid, by black power in the US. So it was quite militant. We're not taking any more of this now, and we'll actually fight people who try.
I remember buying my anti-Nazi League badge and going and protesting down outside the city hall. I can't even remember what we were protesting about, but I was very proud of this badge and that sense of solidarity that it created.
It was. I mean, it was a different era, really, and quite different to what came afterwards when had a kind of rise in northern cities of kind of more Islamicized politics, with an emphasis on faith, religion, and cultural identity. In this case, it was more sort of kind of, for want of a better word, universalist, I guess. I mean, to get a flavour of what these movements were like, let's have a listen to Tariq Mahmood, who was one of the Bradford 12. And the Bradford 12, for those who don't remember, they were part connected with the Asian youth movements, and they were arrested for having petrol bombs and so on in anticipation of racist violence. Yeah. And so they successfully defended themselves and won on the basis of self-defence. So really that was a significant shift from the kind of 1967 era that when we saw in this documentary. Yeah. So let's have a listen to see what Tariq says.
There is a corresponding economic decline that is taking place. The mills are closing down. The old rich British, ruling imperial power is rapidly in a sort of a declining process. And in this declining process, then, we've began to understand, my generation of people who grew up in this country. So we were no longer living in awe of white skins, but we had learned that actually some of them were as oppressed as us, others needed to fight. And we'd also learned that there was a thing and there wasn't a thing called black and white. I have been called a black bastard more times than I can remember. Yet I didn't at first understand what black meant. I began to understand that black was a political term born out of a racist ideology. And that which got us together were our commonalities, some Hindus and Sikhs and Africans, Caribbeans and Muslims and different gradations from across the world, whether we were Chinese or Arabs. We were black in this society, and we were only black in this society. I wasn't an Asian in Pakistan, and my African friends were certainly not an African in Africa. So we became what we became in Britain, and the American black movement affected us greatly. In particular, the speeches of Malcolm X certainly affected me. I must have read or seen or pretty much everything he said. So in one sense, all that was going on, but I became a socialist. And we all became socialists because all my close friends...
Well, that's an interesting interview, isn't it? It kind of really is. Seems to breathe another era
it in does. A way.
And what I think, when I first heard it, that interview, it comes from a much longer interview about that whole experience of the
which is Black really Star... Interesting.
The Asia, Black Star movement, the Asian youth movements, the Bradford 12, comes in as part of a whole longer interview about that. I thought of the Steve McQueen series, the Small Axe films.
Small Axe, absolutely.
Because what I thought when I saw those films and also listened to this interview is this is actually British history.
Yeah, it is.
It's now. Things have changed now, and you now have people who of Asian heritage or Caribbean heritage who see themselves as English, British, as well as black in the broader sense of the word that he describes, fighting for their right to have the same recognition and the same space as everybody else in the North, in this case.
Which and the way he describes that tailing off of empire and what was going on in the indigenous communities at the time, the loss of confidence, and how that created huge tensions, and you see that with the Small Axe as well. These huge tensions between the indigenous white people and those who've come here.
Yeah.
And how those tensions are negotiated politically, sociologically, ideologically. But you're right, it is another era. And that's when you realise things really have changed.
They have, although you can't be over... romantic about it. In 2001, for example, Bradford was hammered by what they call race riots, which were actually provoked by the far right.
Yeah.
But that's where they always describe... I mean, the standard British response is when there's a race riot, in commas, is to find ways... Well, many for years, it was to remove the people who they said caused it. So, after in 1919, after those riots in Liverpool and so on, there were discussions about how to remove the Chinese. Because, of course, they cause it. They're the victims of it, but they cause it.
So you other people and then you push them out.
And that's been a standard kind of official way of dealing with these kind of things for years.
Yeah, but in Bradford, have a big report.
In Bradford, that can't happen anymore.
No.
It can't happen anymore because the people that some elements of the British state would like to remove are citizens of this country.
Yeah.
And not only that, they made Bradford their home.
Yeah.
They navigated their way through the tensions and difficulties of being from that background in that city and subject to these kind of hostile forces.
Exactly. When I worked with the Bangladesh community on Brick Lane, you watched that process going on from being beleaguered and very much an inward-looking community preserving its own, just as the Irish people did when they came, or Jewish people, they preserved their own traditions, their own religion, and create an enclave, but gradually they become more successful economically, politically, sociologically, and they permeate the community around them. And the community around them begin to accept their presence and that leavening process where they start to think, oh, actually, these people are bringing something. And there are tensions, but things have changed. You know, even from when I worked on Brick Lane, you can see how much they've changed.
Yeah.
But in Bradford, I think the idea of this whole podcast, Welcome to the North, that sort of welcome, unwelcoming process has a peculiar kind of chemistry, I think.
It does. And I guess there's also a period that, you know, if you've lived here long enough, if you were born in this country, by the time you get to adulthood, your history is the history of this country now.
Absolutely.
And all the things, the good and bad that come with that.
No, absolutely.
You know, you have that past of your parents and grandparents beforehand, but basically you've lived a a British-English life as an Asian heritage, as a Caribbean heritage, but you've lived that kind of life, yeah. You know, so inevitably going to change your perspective on how you behave in the country, how you see the country, yeah. How you see your city,
yeah.
Where you, or in your neighbourhood when you grew up. I mean, there's a really nice documentary by Farhan Mumtaz,
oh, yeah.
In which he revisits Bradford,
yeah.
And it really gives you a flavour of that, of the, that beautiful. Painful history,
yeah.
And yet kind of accepting it as your own in a way. Should we have a listen to that?
Yeah, let's listen to that.
Dear Bradford, you birthed me, shattering my soul into a thousand pieces across the world, shimmering, scattered. You were the first thing I knew, the first thing I desired, the first thing I questioned, feared, needed to escape. So when the call came to return, I did so with trepidation. It sounds cheesy, but I suppose you only know how much you've changed when you go back to the place you've come from.
What is it, Farhan? Where are you going?
That's really lovely, the way he talks about coming back to the place that he grew up in, and brings all that nuance of what it means to be from an immigrant community, and what it does to his sense of identity.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a kind of painful beauty about it, isn't there?
I love that.
Of kind of...
painful beauty.
Of coming over time to embrace your experience of living in a place that has often been a difficult place, clearly.
He's like a microcosm of his own community.
Yeah,
That accommodation of all that difficulty, all that prejudice and pain, but also... a love for a place, and
he's a northerner.
He's basically a northerner. Absolutely.
Now.
Yeah, yeah, and that process of when a community first arrives here, and that self protection, you saw it with Irish Catholics, you saw it with Jewish people, and then you see it with the Asian community. And then gradually those boundaries on both sides, the indigenous people and the immigrant people, those boundaries start to become more permeable.
Yeah.
Respect begins to grow. And as long as it's not fermented by some right-wing media with their own agenda, that there begins to be some kind of rapprochement but it's fragile.
And it's not kind of necessarily continuously going up in a positive direction. It can be reversed. It can collapse. It can be stuck.
It can be attacked.
I mean, an example would be, say, the protests against the Satanic Verses.
Yeah.
This was kind of like the first time really saw this open shift from the kind of politics that Tariq Mahmood was talking about earlier,
exactly.
To a more kind of faith-based identity politics.
Yeah.
And there was like... This
culture wars.
It was really an early culture war, really, major culture war in this country. And it changed the way British racism framed itself, because before then it had been very oriented towards skin colour,
yes.
And all the kind of pseudo-racist nonsense attached to that. And then you have this thing of it's about culture and religion. Mm. So we're not being racist. You even have, I remember Nick Griffin, when he was once saying, I'm not racist, I'm just talking about religion, he'd say.
Yes.
You had that shift. And that's really not, that's gone on ever since.
And that fantastic preamble. I'm not racist, but...
I'm not racist yet, but... I mean, he got off a trial. He was acquitted in a trial.
Really?
He was basically acquitted because he defended himself on religious grounds.
Right.
It was about religion. So that kind of shift has been there, and it's still present.
Very much so.
You know, but on the other hand, it's not as present as it was once. And these kind of tensions can come and go, and they depend a lot, as you suggest... by how politicians are dealing with it.
No, exactly.
You know?
Language.
Yeah.
That whole thing of the way you use language that projects onto another community or creates a culture war, it scares me how intemperate the language is at the moment.
Very much so. I mean, you enter racist territory when you start portraying an entire group of people as alien, inferior, outsiders, and incapable of change.
Exactly.
And then you start discussing that, do they belong here? And why haven't they become like us?
I had a conversation with two friends of mine, Jason and Sean, who are of Afghani extraction, but have born in Sheffield, grew up in Sheffield, worked in the steelworks. And I said, you know, what are things like now? And they said, well, in the 70s and 80s, you knew where the racism was coming from.
Right.
You could see them coming down the street. They had skinheads and they had bobber boots. He said, now it's coming from politicians. It's coming from the media. It's more insidious.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, Saeed Avarsi was saying exactly that this week.
Was she?
Yeah, she was saying, you know, the racism that she experienced as from Dewsbury, that's where she grew up,
mm-hmm.
is now coming from think tanks and right-wing Tory politicians, and it legitimizes it in a different way, and that makes it so dangerous.
It was interesting, in view of everything we've been talking about. It was really interesting to read Zeba Malik's brilliant book, wasn't it?
It was great.
We're a Muslim, Please, which is basically her autobiographical account of growing up in Bradford in the 70s and 80s and negotiating all these different kinds of tensions, you know, the kind of a very devout father, a very devout Muslim father, and the kind of quite kind of straight-laced, for want of a better word, puritanical background that came out of that, and also had the temptations of kind of English pop culture and clubbing and all these kind of things. She writes absolutely brilliantly about
beautifully about facing in two directions at once. That inward into her community and then outward toward the wider Bradford community. It is one of the best books if you want to understand this, and it was so great to interview her.
I know, and we were lucky enough to do that, weren't
we? Fantastic. She was great.
Yeah, let's see what she had to say.
Yeah, let's.
Yeah, I okay. So basically, the idea for the book just came because I think I'd written a series of articles for the Guardian newspaper, having been a journalist, and it was the editor at the time who decided to put me in touch with some. Literary agents. I kind of went and had a chat. I think I was always petrified about writing my book just because it was a time where there were lots of misery memoirs being published.
Right.
And I think I was just very conscious not to go down that route, actually, because, you know, I think Bradford is a place of lots of contradictions, but, you know, that's life. Life is full of contradictions. So I wanted, I think, to inject maybe a level of humour in it, but I also just really wanted to give a level of warmth to it as well. I mean, you know, I didn't want to completely, you know, put everything about my childhood into a kind of a misery memoir bin as such. So, I think I was just very, very conscious of the balance in the book. And so, you know, obviously writing about your parents becomes very, very tricky. I mean, I think they kind of focus on it a lot more than my siblings, I think, because I, you know, kind of had learned so much from my mum and dad because there were so many differences between me and my parents that I was obviously just very, very intrigued in. And I think even from a young generation, I was very intrigued by even how in one generation, things could change quite dramatically. I mean, I didn't know much about my dad's upbringing, but what I knew that he grew up in a very rural kind of poor village. He had lots of siblings. I think that he kind of lost quite a few siblings in early life, just because they didn't have the system in Pakistan to kind of look after people who were ill. So, I just got the impression from my dad that he was very motivated to have a life that was better for him and therefore also for his children. There was certainly a point to my dad and the way that he was going to raise his children. But it wasn't all completely rosy, quite frankly, because he was definitely torn in terms of that thing of wanting a better life for himself and for any children he may have at that time. But also he'd grown up in this very, very strong cultural and religious kind of country, basically. It wasn't even a community, it was a whole country of Pakistan, you know, that kind of Islam was at the kind of core of everything that most people did. So he'd grown up in that. So I think it was tricky for him. So I just wanted, I think, to have maybe a gentler view of my parents, really.
The title of this episode is Welcome to the North, and it's looking at...
With a question mark.
Yeah.
Right.
So your description just then of your dad's, you know, entry into England, into Britain, and what he was straddling, and then the way you describe what you are straddling, you know, it's just such a great description of looking in two directions at the same time, and what a tension that is. I presume it was a big tension from the book.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of past the worst of it now. I mean, I have my own family. I have a young son. So it's quite interesting to see childhood through another person's eyes. But I think, yeah, I you know what kids are like. They kind of live and breathe everything a much more than kind of grown-ups do. I think, you know, their context and their kind of scale of life is obviously just much smaller, isn't it? So actually just small things like fitting in become absolutely paramount, don't they? So, yeah, I think probably I didn't realise what a toll it was taking on me.
Yeah.
For quite a few decades, to be honest. And actually the book, I think the book made me recognize maybe what I'd gone through. But then I think the feedback was also from people who were kind enough to write to me, was that actually that was also, you know, you didn't have to be a Muslim, a British Muslim growing up in Bradford to have that. I think, you know, that kind of trying to fit in, but also in a way trying to kind of maybe appease, stroke please your parents, do the right thing, is very, very hard. You know, I think there are those people in life who are absolutely determined to kind of go their own path, and it's almost regardless of what other people want. And I think maybe I didn't have that in me, and I just kind of was always trying to be very diplomatic about it. But yes, it was tough on the time, and I think it caught up with me after a while, and now I'm all right with it. Yeah, it gave me resilience in life, right?
Right.
Yeah. It really did. So I'm grateful to it for that. I think on the whole, I'm a fairly resilient person, quite good at navigating things. So it's given me life skills, which are kind of never to be frowned upon, as far as I'm concerned, really.
Did you the way you describe the North, or particularly the Bradford part of the North that you grew up in, it's not entirely unwelcoming, but it's not exactly welcoming either.
No, and it's that contradiction thing again, isn't it? Yeah. You know, I've been living in London for a few years, and you know, my son always tells me off for talking to strangers, right? he just, you know, what are you doing? But you know, that's part and parcel of who I am. So I think that I miss so much by living in the capital. I really do. I really miss, genuinely. I mean, it's a real cliche, isn't it? But often there's truth in cliches, that actually the friendliness of the North is I think is very, very hard to find in lots of other places.
You feel that, do you?
Yeah, completely. Do you know what? I never feel like London's been my home, really.
Right.
I feel like I'm just living here rather than, yeah, kind of, you know. There's something about Bradford and Yorkshire generally. I mean, I was just saying that I studied in Sheffield to do journalism. My first job was in Manchester, so I'm kind of talking about the North just generally. So, you know, I had great times in Manchester, I had a great time in Sheffield. And I think there's just, I don't know, there's just an affinity, there's a shorthand, isn't there, that you kind of deal with people. But of course, you know, there's another aspect, whereas people may be more, I'm not sure if this is true, actually. Okay, so what am I going to say? I'm going to say that actually, you know, it kind of diversity is much more visible in London, isn't it? Because it's the capital and you kind of get people living here for all kinds of reasons. So I'm not quite sure what the level of unhappiness towards others is in the North at the moment. I was actually just having a look at the demographics today because I thought it would be quite interesting to see that. I see that in Bradford, it's a fairly kind of even split of if religion's got anything to do with it, a third of people are Christian, a third of people are Muslim, a third of people are no religion at all, right? So you can't get more even than that, can you really? But I don't know. I still come up to Bradford because my family still live there. But I don't know. I can't understand where the tensions lie anymore. I think it's quite hard to understand where they lie. I know there was quite a lot of tension with East Europeans coming in for quite a while. So then they were the subject of all of that stuff that we dealt with in the 60s and the 70s. But yeah, I'm not quite sure where the kind of racial tension is in Bradford anymore.
You talk about dealing with it in your book, but the way you dealt with it was quite different to the way, say, some of the women in your family, who you call the aunties, dealt with it. I mean, you were much more defiant.
Confrontational.
And not take it. Do you think, could you say that there was that generational divide in the way that people responded to racism in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I certainly saw it with my dad, and we had quite a lot of a few incidents that I saw with my dad. So there were times where I recall getting like hate mail coming through our front door. And there would be times also just where how people spoke to my mum and dad, just in a really, really rude way. And I really didn't like it at all. I didn't like it. It really annoyed me. So yes, I think I maybe it was just a different perspective because I'd been born in Yorkshire. And, you know, I, for all those reasons, completely classed myself as a Brit and had every right to be there. So maybe I had a slightly different perspective, but I certainly remember. Yeah, I think that there was definitely generation because, you know, they were immigrants. So they were, I think, in a way, you know, they'd come into work. A lot of them had lost their jobs in the mills. That's what they'd come over for specifically. So I think, you know, there was a level of vulnerability there, actually, that next stop would be back home, really. So I think if they were. There was a lot of pressure, and understandably, to kind of not make a fuss, right? So yeah, and I think that was also difficult. It was problematic as well, because I'm sure there were lots of people who had really horrific experiences, you know, at work or at home, or kind of, you know, just culturally. But yeah, it's quite hard to, I think, absorb all of that, isn't it? You know, you just want to get on with your life, and it's not easy.
What a great interview. She articulates all the things that we've been trying
to
say.
She does, really. Yeah, she does. Yeah, and that whole thing of it's not easy.
Yeah.
But it happens anyway, you know. I mean, I was thinking in regard to that interview, you know, there was an incident in 1961 in Middlesbrough, when a Somali sailor called Hassan Saeed was caught in a fight with a local apprentice moulder.
Right.
And in the fight, the moulder, his name was John Joseph Hunt, was killed, and Saeed was charged with the murder. Then what happened after that? There were clashes all over the Cannon Street area of Middlesbrough, in which a lot of it was centred around the Taj Mahal Cafe, which was owned by an English woman called Mrs. Mayer, who was married to a Pakistani.
Right.
And the Middlesbrough magistrate, Alfred Peaker, told the riots, "I have no doubt that this affair started through some individuals visiting public houses and then trying to whip up feeling against some of these coloured people living in the Cannon Street area. The evidence shows," he said, "that the coloured population were quiet and peaceful and never did anything at all to give any provocation, but they were attacked." So at one level, you have that kind of hostility. The potential for it was always present.
Yeah.
And to some extent still is.
And that's what she's talking about.
And that's what she's talking about.
The way her parents kept their heads down. And it's such a great book, because although she's dealing with really difficult subjects, she does it with real grace and humour.
She does.
And the way she paints the picture of her family, they're so real, the aunties and the things that go on the street and all of that. It's so rich.
It's a world that has not been publicly recognised in this country. And in the same way as the small axe films, showed slices of history that have never really been visible in this country.
That lovely bit where she talks about her mum writing to the Queen saying, "I'd like to come and cook for you."
Yeah.
And the that whole "We are Muslim, please."
Yeah.
It's so delicately described, and the bit where she talks about this thing in the middle of Ramadan and the night of power.
Yes.
Where if you stay up all night and pray, you get what you want.
And you see angels.
Yeah.
And in Bradford.
It's like Blake.
It is. It's very Blakean description there.
It's beautiful.
And then, of course, you know, despite all the difficulties that she talks about of her parents' kind of arrival in the UK and her own experiences growing up in it, she also says this.
Yeah. This is amazing.
I'm so proud to come from a city where Priestley, you know, has Priestley, as Hockney, as Alan Bennett. You know, I think it's just right across the board.
I love the way she references all these other people from Bradford. And there she is up in that little pantheon.
And she's part of that tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. Great.
And that process of that kind of painful and difficult, but nevertheless, the alchemy you talked about has obviously occurred in her case. And, you know, it made me think of the C.N.R. James, a famous cricket writer, C.N.R. James, Trinidadian cricket writer.
Oh, yeah.
Came to England with Sir Leary Constantine, cricketer, who later became a barrister, KC.
Yeah, extraordinary person.
Anyway, they arrived at Nelson to play
In Lancashire,
yeah, to play league cricket. Very niche sport at that time.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And at that time, this is what C.L.R. James says about that arrival. He says, "Life in Nelson was not easy and could not be otherwise. Apart from someone who went around collecting refuse in an old pushcart, Leary and I were the only coloured men in Nelson. That meant wherever you went and whatever you did, you were automatically under observation. Mm-hmm. Constantine lived the life placidly enough, but at times he would just pick himself up and on the slightest excuse, go off to the anonymity of London or even Manchester. There had been prejudice at the beginning, but by 1932, the Constantine family were Nelson citizens. When he finally decided to leave, all Nelson asked him to stay. He had conquered the hearts of the Nelson people. That story is sufficiently known. What is not known is that the Nelson people conquered him."
That's such a hopeful quote, and what Zaba said, it just makes you feel hopeful that these communities can find friendship with one another and begin that process of integration, whatever word you want to use, friendship.
Yeah, it's the hope you always have that without malicious protagonists trying to manipulate basically stoke up hatreds for whatever benefits they think they can get out of them. If that can be stopped, then you have the possibility that these kind of things can happen, don't you? I mean, we've talked about a lot now about the unwelcoming side of the North. We've talked about the lout with the brick in the hand. We talked about exploitation in the workplace, you know, of South Asian immigrants who came to Bradford and so on. But then what has always been that other side as well. And this is a side in which the North has actually embraced outsiders from the beginning. And there have been quite a few incidents of that. And in terms of the hope you're talking about, that is where the hope come from, that those possibilities are there, aren't there? I mean, like, take this clip here.
Yes.
This is an old PATH News clip from the Spanish Civil War. Not specifically connected with the North, but we'll see.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Arrived at Southampton on the steamship Havana. Imagination runs riot as these little ones come ashore. They have said goodbye to homes and mothers and fathers. Everything is being done for their care and comfort, but nothing can replace what they have lost. This is the price of war, paid by those who should know nothing of its horrors.
We wish to thank the English people for their kindness, and we are here much better than in Bilbao now.
The heart bleeds for these children. It is a grim reflection on our civilization.
Interesting to hear that now, isn't it? I mean, there's plenty of grim reflections on our civilization right now, aren't there?
God, yeah.
But the interesting thing about that is that clip of Southampton, 1937, where thousands of Basque children were brought into the country and dispersed around the country.
Right.
Lots of them came to the north of England.
Right.
Lots came. And there's a very good reason for that. There was a strong connection of solidarity between various northern cities and the Basques.
Yeah.
I mean, in May 1937, Newcastle cargo ships took part in a massive rescue scheme to bring Basque refugees to UK. And they also took them to France after the fall of Bilbao to Franco's troops.
Right.
And the level of solidarity was such that on one ship, the crew of the ship was called the Blackworth. The crew subscribed out of their own pay to buy food parcels Bilbao. And so they took these ships, participated in the mass evacuation of Bilbao. Some 30,000 Basques were taken to France. But many of these kids were brought to the north. So like 250 children were brought to Manchester, 54 were housed in an old mansion near Bolton. Yeah. There's a kind of coalition of communist, Catholic Church and liberals all working together. And Froggatt Edge. There was a holiday fellowship guest house at Froggatt near Sheffield. They put up 25 children there.
I remember going to a talk in Sheffield of a guy that fought in the International Brigade from Sheffield saying, I remember him saying, someone said to him, why did you were 18, why did you sign up? He said, we have to fight fascism, we knew it. And that was that sort of response of working class northern people to the plight of people in another country.
Exactly, and it also translates in certain times to a willingness to help people in distress. Absolutely. I mean, even in 1917, despite what we said earlier about the Irish, T.P. O'Connor, MP, an advocate of Irish Home Rule, was fulsome in his praise of the welcome that 19th century Newcastle extended to Irish migrants. He said, of the many asylums to which the Irish fled after the great exodus of the 40s, there was none in which, owing to many circumstances, they were ultimately able to find more favourable circumstances than on Tyneside.
Wow.
And you see things like, do you remember where the coup in Chile in 1973, yes. Sheffield in particular, extended a huge welcome to Chilean refugees. And a lot of them are still here.
Yeah.
They're still here, and their children and grandchildren are speaking in Sheffield accents now.
And that makes you feel really proud.
It does. And it should really, because it's out of those kind of sparks of solidarity and humanity that one has to take some solace, especially in these dark times that we're living in now.
It's that moment when people feel solidarity with each other, when they feel compassion for each other and want to build on that.
Yeah. And the question of who's an insider and who's an outsider
exactly
breaks down and disappears, doesn't it?
You know, in Sheffield, you've got Assist, which I interviewed all the founders of Assist, and one of them was the head of public health in Sheffield, but him and his wife had been in Africa on health projects, and they were horrified by the treatment of refugees of asylum seekers, and that once their claim had been denied, they were literally destitute, and she said to me, we could not countenance that type of inhospitality, that type of nastiness being visited on these people who when we had been in their countries had offered us such incredible hospitality.
Too right, something we need to remember more than ever in these times.
It was the beginning of the City of Sanctuary movement.
Yeah, 2007, Sheffield became the UK's first City of Sanctuary. I remember when I came to Sheffield the first time in 2017, I met Magic Majid, who was going to become... He wasn't Lord Mayor then, but he was going to become it. His first words to me was, what took you so long to get to Sheffield? Bearing in mind that he came here when he was three.
Yeah.
So, you know, the North has also been a place in which you can arrive here, the son of a Somali refugee at the age of three, and you can become Lord Mayor. And where you can have an Ethiopian poet like Len Sisse can become Chancellor of Manchester University.
And what I think happens, what we've witnessed in this podcast, is that people come here, they become members of our community, they are the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they become part of the welcome of the North.
Yeah, exactly
What people go to Bradford because of the culture and the food that they experience from the people of Pakistani origin, the North becomes this jigsaw, this cornucopia of cultures that people want to come to. They are the welcome of the North.
That's what one wants to see.
Well, I hope
what one wants to see, and it's beautifully celebrated in Lim Sisse's amazing poem, Anthem of the North. And I think that's probably the right time to leave this podcast, isn't it?
It is.
We should say, please come listen to our next podcast. It's going to be very different to anything we've done before, isn't it?
Very different. A big experiment. We're gonna walk somewhere. We're gonna go on a perambulation of a city.
A perambulation through the past, present, and future of a northern city. And we intend to do this in the future. We're going to be doing at least one program will be
in each series
about a walk in each series. Yeah. And this is the next one. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Out and about. Yes.
Until then, let's hear Lem Sisse.
Brilliant.
The North Star leads the way to the mountain top in awe. That, my friend, is why they say up, up, up north. And so we build year after year, and we rise tide after time, and we bring light to darkness, and we shine. Welcome to our future and all she endows. This is our dream, our vision. This is our power, our house. Even the tides of oceans speak of you upon their chosen course. Bring as many waves as you can, they say, for we are heading north. And they come in waves to kiss our coast, urged on by the north wind. The surge of river greets the sea. Come in, it says, come in. And the A's, the E's, the I's, the O's, the U's, flocks of vowels fill the night with song. Great they are, and migrate they do. The North is where they belong. Daughters of suffragettes, sons of minds, the digital revolution, the creation, true North, you North, the heart of our nation. And our children grow wings, soar across this earth, but home, they are assured, is the greatest place on earth. Oh, North, North, I love you. You made me the best I could be. You waited with open arms and took in a stranger like me. We are the beautiful North. The darkness of night bows. We are a waterfall of light. This is our power, our house.